Hello, and welcome to the Jacobite Podcast, Episode 22, The March on London. So, I'm back, after taking a somewhat unintentionally extended hiatus, consequences of work life building up and too much too soon in trying to do this. I'm learning a lot in terms of scheduling. I'm now back, and I'm going to continue pressing on with this podcast to the end. So, if you'll permit me, on with the show. Throughout October 1745, Prince Charles celebrated in Edinburgh and welcomed many new recruits to the Jacobite army. I use the term recruited here somewhat loosely, given that, like previous risings, the Jacobite lords would go to their tenants and announce they'd serve or suffer the consequences. Given many of these tenants were bound by loyalty and lease to these lords, there was little option but to grab your pitchfork and march on. Some did try to resist and suffered. In many cases, their houses were set ablaze. There are also some accounts of the Duke of Perth ordering three tenants to be shot for trying to refuse to serve. Towards the end of the month, Charles raised the issue of invading England. Despite this being Charles's objective from the beginning, the issue itself proved to be quite divisive. Whilst many were eager to invade England, buoyed by the victory at Prestonpans and ready to win the favour of Charles, some were not. Among these detractors was Lord George Murray. Murray, like many of the Scottish officers, felt that the best choice of the Jacobites was to preserve the gains made in Scotland, and to consolidate their power base there before moving on to England. Other Scottish lords and soldiers felt Scotland had been liberated from England, and the Hanoverians done away with, so as far as many of the Scots were concerned, job done. It was time to pick up the sweet loot they'd got from the government forces and head for home. It was a fact that many of the Highlanders in the Jacobite army were considering this, or, with their ill-gotten gains from Edinburgh and Prestonpans, had already done so. It may have been this that helped persuade Charles to strike whilst the iron was hot, not wanting to lose his army, and also wanting to go to London to seize the crown of England. In Charles's mind, London was the true goal, and in the eyes of Stuart royals, their birthright. Johnston and others later went on to accuse Charles of an almost fever-like obsession with taking England, sometimes to the detriment of all else. The Scottish contingent of the Jacobites would blame the Irish contingent for stoking this idea, but it's clear Charles wanted to go to England and there was going to be no stopping him. Despite their protestations, Charles stated, "I find, gentlemen, that you are for staying in Scotland and defending your country, and I am resolved to go to England." The Scots, wanting to remain on the right side of the king, decided to go along with the plan, with an important condition. The army would march down the west of England, as it was argued the hilly terrain would be of greater benefit to their fighting forces. In hindsight, this would probably be a beneficial move. It was probably going to be easier to move past Carlisle, then head for the northern city of Newcastle, which was currently garrisoned by Marshal George Wade, who was preparing to move to neutralise the Jacobites. And so it was that Charles and Jacobite army evacuated Edinburgh, and by Halloween 1745, around 5,000 troops and 450 cavalry were on the march. A third of the troops were Lowlanders who were picked up en route. The troops split into two detachments, partly to allow quicker troops to act as a vanguard, and partly to mislead Wade in Newcastle they were coming to seize the city. Now Wade of course didn't fall for this, and he started to move his troops across to Carlisle. But the infamous British winter struck to render this effort impossible. With deteriorating roads and heavy snows, the men, and more crucially the artillery, could not make their way to engage the Jacobites, and so had to limp back to the safety of the city of Newcastle. It was here that Wade wrote to Cumberland, blaming the weather, his age, and the fact his men just could not make the trip to defend Carlisle. For the man who had helped reform the infrastructure of the country and defend it, this must have been a great embarrassment to Wade, being stranded in Newcastle, far away from the fight. While in Newcastle, Wade did receive some good news from Scotland. Duncan Forbes had sent word to Wade and the Hanoverian administration. The Lord of Culloden House had been on a recruitment drive and managed to rally 700 Highlanders, plus another 400 from the Clan MacLeod. Bad news, these troops were probably unlikely to be in a capacity to attack the Jacobite forces. Rather, they could probably regain the areas of Scotland that were lost and stem the flow of Jacobite volunteers, in particular acting as a block to any potential Fraser and Gordon involvement. They were still wavering at this point. This would be a glad tiding to government forces, but unfortunately, would not do much for the town of Carlisle, which was now firmly in Jacobite sights. Carlisle at this point was a garrison town on the northwest of England. The fortresses here still stood, but the garrison had been somewhat neglected. This was owing to the fact that the Act of Union and 2 decades since the 15 Rising, the threat from Scotland had been greatly diminished. 40 troops, mostly veterans of previous continental battles, were there in what would some consider a retirement posting. Lieutenant John Gilpin was therefore good to monitor a town, but he was probably as shocked as anyone hearing of the Jacobite advance. On November 9th, despite some reinforcements being sent and the dawning realisation of an invasion coming, Jacobite forces were spotted approaching Carlisle. I'm sure that some of the people there prayed that, much like in the earlier rising in 1715, when James's armies had swept to Preston, that the army would simply bypass Carlisle. But those hopes would have been dashed on November 10th, 1745, when the Jacobites converged on the city. When the morning fog lifted, the garrison saw the true numbers they were up against. The Jacobite forces debated between siege warfare and an all-out assault. During this, the garrison artillery opened fire. This was a defiant gesture, but ultimately a futile one, given that the Jacobites just moved out of range and repositioned their own artillery in a new area. At 3 p.m. on Sunday, November 11th, a messenger arrived to the gates with a proclamation from Prince Charles, regent for King James III of England and the 8th of Scotland. The deputy mayor of Carlisle, Thomas Pattinson, read the missive from Charles. It stated the prince was here to seize back his father the king's land from the usurpers. Whilst Charles wished to avoid bloodshed, he was not afraid to play hardball. His proclamation warned that Carlisle had 2 hours to open its gates and surrender to the Jacobites, or Charles would order the army to siege Carlisle and bomb it to ashes or submission, whichever one of the two came first. The garrison at Carlisle responded by firing its guns. The die had been cast, and after a 2-day diversion, marching to meet Wade's non-existent advance, Charles summoned his war council. It was decided that both the Duke of Perth and Lord George Murray would march back and commence the siege. Carlisle had cheered the seeming Jacobite retreat and started to draft missives celebrating the town's resilience and steadfastness in taking on the Jacobite rebels. Carlisle and its citizens must have been crestfallen when the Jacobite forces returned on November 13th and began to build fortifications and trenches. The weather gradually worsened and the Jacobite men were slowly losing faith that they'd be able to take the fort. Their luck held out, however, as the morale of Carlisle's citizens plunged quicker, with no sign of any relief force, and then confirmation that Wade was never coming. The garrison attempted to negotiate a similar holdout to Edinburgh, where the castle could be held by government forces and the town given to Charles's army. But Charles and his officers had learnt their mistakes from that one, and told Carlisle's grandees the town and the garrison surrender at the same time, or the siege would continue to the bitter end. It was felt there was no choice, and so after 4 days, Carlisle capitulated to the Jacobite army and opened the gates. The Jacobites swept into Carlisle on November 16th, 1745. The town relieved their buildings were standing and their lives no longer under threat. The Jacobites jubilant because their massive bluff had worked. Both Quartermaster O'Sullivan and the Chevalier de Johnston, in their accounts, later stated it was a relief the town surrendered, as the only cannons the Jacobites had were Swedish 4-pounders, which would barely have made a dent in the fort walls. Thus the Jacobites played up to the propaganda that they would mercilessly raise the town. This terrified the populace into avoiding bloodshed, and therefore they surrendered to the Jacobites. Carlisle's mayor and other leaders met Charles, some reports have them kneeling to the prince and handing him the keys not only to the garrison but the city. The prince rode triumphant on a white horse, with Highlanders cheering and church bells ringing. The Duke of Perth, with city officials in attendance and under severe Jacobite supervision, proclaimed James as King of Scotland and England. The Jacobites now officially invaded and seized territory in England. But once again, the Jacobite War Council had indecision rear its ugly head. Despite seizing Carlisle without a shot, there was still dissent as to which way to go. The pessimistic and cautious factions, as well as several Scots nationalists, urged a return to Scotland to consolidate their gains, await French support, and then possibly march on England when full strength. The other faction, buoyed by victory, urged Charles to march to London under their rationale, storming through, seizing more territory, and showing the French they were strong and powerful allies. This in turn could spur the French to commit a significant invasion force to sandwich the Hanoverians and force a transfer of power back to the House of Stuart. Charles was understandably part of the latter faction. In his mind, he'd come for London. He was getting the crown. He was focused on this. Taking back Scotland had been great, but it was never the overall goal. It was simply a step, which was always the eternal disappointment of the Scottish Jacobites. But ultimately, he was their prince and their regent, and many probably felt duty-bound to follow. Except, of course, for Lord George Murray. Lord George had once again got his nose out of joint. He'd suggested a troop rotation of besieging forces. Despite what would be a mild and relatively reasonable request, it was decided not to go in that direction. Now, in most top-down command structures, especially the military, once a decision is made, they tend to expect you to follow orders, despite your reservations. Not so Lord George. As the Jacobites took Carlisle, he fired off a letter to the Prince, resigning his commission as an army officer. In his letter, he complained that Charles barely listened to his advice, and wishing to serve his master the King, which you can only take as a swipe at Charles being Prince and not King, George proposed he instead serve as a Jacobite volunteer. To Sullivan, MacDonald and other Murray detractors, that was good riddance. His letter was presumptive, rude, and it violated all decorum in dealing with a royal, with George off prone to lecturing the young prince. And in all fairness, they had a point. I am, as may or may not be obvious, a bit of a Lord George defender, but even I'll acknowledge there are times he makes that a really difficult job. He was clearly abrasive, difficult to work with, and keen to establish his own expertise, sometimes to the cost and belittlement of others. But he did know some level of military tactical knowledge, which for me helps show why he was necessary, despite his completely antagonistic personality. The victory for his enemies, however, was short-lived, as the Duke of Perth also resigned his commission to command his own regiment, and as such, Charles appointed as Lieutenant General and overall lone command, Lord George Murray. It seemed his resignation was somewhat reconsidered, and chastening himself to a degree, stuck to advising the pros and cons of advancing to England, confident that the English Jacobites in hiding would rise up. Unsure of this, but readily taking advantage of the victory and momentum, the Jacobites pressed on. As the Jacobites headed to Lancaster, in a bid to secure more towns and rally English Jacobites, government loyalists were in a state of panic. Everyone had been sure this rebellion of a bunch of nobodies could be steamrolled without any major trouble. Whether this was cockiness, bad intelligence, or a mix of the two is debatable, but after Preston Pans, there was a growing sense of alarm. They still felt the Jacobites should be defeated, and the minute that William Augustus, the King's son and Duke of Cumberland, swept in, that would be the end of it. But the Jacobites were still advancing, and help was not forthcoming. The Jacobites could sweep through because many of these areas were minimally defended. It had been 30 years since England had been assaulted by the Jacobites, and peace had reigned relatively well on the British mainland. Therefore, given that most of British forces were fighting on the European continent, the home defences were severely scaled back. This meant that even a relatively under-equipped force like Charles's could, under the right circumstances, take control of towns with minimal resistance. The Jacobite vanguard next arrived at Preston on November 26th, with Lord Elcho and Lord George Murray. They passed through the town and set up camp a mile south of it to await Charles's arrival. To Jacobite leaders, this was a symbolic act, to show that their troops, unlike the Rising of 1715, we'll conveniently forget the one that took place in Scotland in 1719, Preston would not be their furthest advance south. Charles would come, and they'd have Jacobites, Englishmen, and Scotsmen together rallied to march on London. Charles then marched into Preston at the head of his troops to even louder cheers, shouts, and even several huzzas, according to later Jacobite chroniclers. Charles, who presumably giddy with the fact that the town was clamouring for copies of his manifesto, would probably expect men running from all over the county, as his advisers had said they would at the sight of their true prince. These men would all sign up, don the white cockade, and help depose the hated Hanoverians. If this was indeed Charles's belief, he was to be sorely disappointed. The amount of troops was nowhere near what he had hoped. Having been convinced people would flock to his banner, It made sense he'd be confused that people didn't rush to fight, but in truth, it's simple to explain if you look at the plight of the English Jacobites. The last time they'd hit England, in 1715, there were fierce reprisals for English Jacobites. Executions and land seizures top among them. There was also the matter of the constantly promised French invasion. Charles continually stated the French were poised to invade the country from the south in support of King James. But, bar the landing of troops in Montrose that arrived in November, that was around 800 men that seized the port town to allow French arms and shipping through, the troops were mainly the wild geese, who were the Irish Jacobites who signed up for training and service in the French army. I mean, 800 is not an army. Some English Jacobites were advising a more wait-and-see attitude to see if the French would commit to Charles and support as promised. Charles insisted this would come and urged his men on. Their next target was Manchester. What followed next is the stuff of Jacobite legend, as the Chevalier de Johnston, in his account, names a sergeant called Dixon, who had nothing more than his mistress and a drummer boy, decided to march on Manchester. Arriving in the city, Dixon and his entourage began to drum up support for Charles, even offering 5 guineas as an incentive. Now, there's 2 theories as to what happened next. Townsfolk and inhabitants of Manchester claim many pro-Hanoverians had fled, and that those who stayed believed the Jacobites were heading towards Liverpool first. Believing that the army was imminent, the town brooked no resistance, therefore earning Dixon legendary status and giving Jacobite command a scathing impression of the English militia forces, who seemingly had disintegrated before the army even arrived. The other, more swashbuckling version comes from Johnston, which claims that on arrival, Sergeant Dixon was set upon by Hanoverians and almost had to fire his blunderbuss into the crowd, had a band of Jacobite sympathisers not swooped in and saved him. Now, regardless, depending which one's true, the Jacobites entered Manchester on November 29th, 1745. Again, the Jacobite accounts are filled with Charles entering to pealing bells and cheering crowds. Men were billeted in the houses of Mancunians, and yet another city was taken without a shot. But that was where the good news started to dry up. Firstly, there was the slow emerging truth that the English Jacobites, and by extension, English subjects in general, were somewhat reluctant to join the fray. Charles had been reliably informed by his supporters there could be anywhere up to 1,500 people wanting to sign up. When they raised a Manchester regiment of English volunteers for the Prince, they scraped together 200, out of a town that had a population at the time of 20,000. This was, to put it mildly, a disappointment. Either the English weren't as loyal as they made out, or they were being cautious. Either way, support was hardly forthcoming, which would be an area many of the Army of the 45 would focus on in later accounts as a major shortcoming of the Rising. The second issue opening up for the Jacobite Army was setting up shop in Lichfield. William Augustus, the Duke of Cumberland, had arrived by that time that Charles had taken Preston and took command of the army there. Cumberland had received his orders from his father, King George II, to march the army to defend Derby, roughly 25 miles to the northeast of the government positions. Cumberland, in all truth, didn't wish to be in England taking on rebels. He wanted to fight on the continent, pushing back the French. He felt this whole Jacobite rebellion thing was a distraction. He may even believe that the hand of France was behind it. Many in London did feel that the French were using the Jacobites as a way to divert forces from the continent, similar to how King Louis XIV had done so in Ireland in the 1690s. Cumberland was going to crush this threat and get back to smacking King Louis XV around. The British forces were billeted in and around Lichfield and Tamworth, with the aim to be able to equally defend Chester or Derby. Cumberland was wanting to be able to take his time and engage Charles, but he had a trick up his sleeve. He'd been in regular contact with Marshal Wade in Newcastle. The plan was to have Wade swing in behind the Jacobites and sandwich them between the 2 sets of government forces. By the time the plot was devised, however, it was reported the Jacobites had seized Manchester and were preparing to move. Current intel suggested Wade was only about 30 miles south of Newcastle by this point, and he was never going to be able to get there. Cumberland mused that all the fighting would probably be over by the time old Wade finally arrived. Further south, the king was going to take no chances. Despite highly qualified officers, the spectre of the rout of government forces at Prestonpans still hung over everyone. At Finchley Common, a muster order had been issued. As a last-ditch effort to prevent Jacobites hitting London, the Hanoverian administration began to form a defence force. Realising the difficulty in trying to take up positions in the city itself, a force of several thousand and 35 artillery pieces were put in the place that logically felt stood between London and an advancing Jacobite force. By December, men stood 12 miles northwest of London. The city itself was a mix of those who were raising the defence of London and fundraising for the army, to those nervously awakened to see what would happen. News journals such as the True Patriot told horror stories of marauding Highlanders and Jacobite agents who spread the rumours that King George had packed all of his belongings into a boat on the Thames and was ready to depart at the first sign of trouble. The capital, at the start of December 1745, held its breath. At around the same time, on December 4th, 1745, Charles and the Jacobites marched on Derby, the next major population centre en route to London. As with other towns, bonfires were lit and church bells were rung. Charles bedded down for the night at Exeter House, a mansion property, to dine with his men after proclaiming his father the true king. The mayor of Derby tried to meet Charles, but was thrown down the stairs by Highlanders after asking to speak to the pretender. The Highlander who threw the mayor down the stairs told him if he wanted to go and speak to the pretender, he should go and ask for George in London. The next day, Charles and his commanders met at Exeter House to discuss their next move. Obviously, Charles was moving full steam ahead to London. He was 120 miles out and, by his own army's estimates, able to be reached within 4 days. During this meeting, a man stated that as well as armies under Cumberland and Wade, a third army was closing in on Northampton. The man who relayed that message was Captain Oliver Williams, who'd rushed to inform the prince of this dangerous new development. It would later transpire this man was actually called Dudley Bradstreet, and he was an Irish agent of the Hanoverian government, who was informing Cumberland of troop numbers and intentions. Now, I don't know whether he told this story about a third army, which was a complete fabrication, on the orders of a higher-up, or took the initiative himself, but suffice to say, the piece of disinformation had its desired effect and distorted the perception of events and left an almighty rift in the Jacobite War Council as to what to do. The prince ordered the bringer of doom be removed from the council, but the damage was done. There was a large contingent of the staff, Lord George Murray amongst them, who felt it was best to return to Scotland, which they felt was easily defended and had far shorter supply lines, which were dangerously overstretched by the advance, beyond the goods obtained on the march paid for with Charles's patented brand of Jacobite IOUs. For the Scots especially, they were concerned with mission creep. They'd only wanted to liberate Scotland, but for the prince's exhortations. In their eyes, the English support never materialised as promised, and besides Montrose, there was nothing of French support Charles promised as a whole reason to support him in the first place. Charles and his supporters responded that if they struck while the iron was hot, they could take London to prove to King Louis that they were serious, and they would fly support across the Channel. As it happened, after Prestonpans, the French were looking into compiling a new invasion fleet, and the other Stuart prince, Henry Benedict, was in Paris, ready to lead an invasion force. Or at the very least give the impression that he was ready to lead an invasion force. The prince also claimed a certain level of exasperation with his officers. In all fairness, Charles had a point here. His argument was that he'd been consistently on message since day one. London or bust. Despite Scottish Jacobite nationalist sentiments, seizing Edinburgh and building administration there was never the intention. Scots fighters were, in general, happy to take their land back, repeal the Act of Union and make an independent Jacobite Scotland. Charles castigated the men in torrents of what Elcho would call abusive language, but he was outnumbered. He might be their prince, but he could hardly move without an army. Despite threats to go on with his Irish troops, who mostly wanted to press on, Charles reluctantly accepted the majority, and with George Murray leading, the Jacobite army would be ordered on a fighting retreat back to Scotland. Next time, we will cover the Jacobite army and its fighting retreat to safer ground in the Highlands. We will also cover the ferocious and relentless pursuit by the Duke of Cumberland's forces. The tide has now turned for the Jacobites, and those who know the story may now know we are fast approaching the Highland Moors and a dramatic showdown of Culloden.